Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, March 23rd, 2016. More than 3,000 South Sudanese refugees have sought refuge in Uganda this year alone.
And they're telling us that they're fleeing armed militia groups that are looting villages, burning down houses, sexually assaulting women and girls, and forcibly recruiting children into their ranks.
And South Sudan's Minister of Finance says the government has no money to pay for hotel bills of the former SPLM detainees. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Belgium authorities are continuing to search for one of the men believed to be responsible for Tuesday's airport and metro bombings in Brussels, which killed at least 31 people and wounded 271 others. Belgium federal prosecutor Frederik Van confirmed that two brothers, Khalid and Ibrahim Al-Bukhari, were the suicide bombers killed in the attacks. Van says 27-year-old Khalid blew himself up on a metro train at the Malebec station, and 29-year-old Ibrahim carried out one of the two suicide explosions at the airport. Both men, who were identified by their fingerprints, were Belgian nationals and had criminal records for armed robbery. Khalid had been wanted on charges of terrorism, according to red notice issued by Interpol. A three-day consultation meeting in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, between Sudanese government officials and the rebels of the SPLM North, Darfur rebel factions and the Umma National Party ended this week, with Sudan government officials signing what is being called as roadmap agreement on how to end the conflict in Darfur, Blue Nile and Southern Kordofan. SPLM North and other rebels refused to endorse the roadmap or sign the agreement, calling it a government blueprint. Former South African President Thabo Mbeki is the chairman of the African Union High Implementation Panel for Sudan, a body mediating the talks between the Sudanese government and rebels in Darfur, Blue Nile and Southern Kordofan. Mbeki urged the warring parties in Sudan to seek a lasting solution to the conflict in the three regions of Sudan. The Secretary General of SPLM North says the roadmap agreement has nothing new in it. Yasir Arman says the government of Sudan is simply buying time to prepare for more fighting in Blue Nile and Southern Kordofan states.
That there should be a preparatory meeting, but the government of Sudan, they refused this preparatory meeting for long, and they went ahead with their national dialogue. And surprisingly, the document that was produced by the mediation, it was the same ideas of the Sudan government, and they defied the mediation and the Sudan government to sign it. Even they did not wait for us to see our reply to their document.
Arman says his group is ready to go to Sudan for the national dialogue, but he says the government must first declare a ceasefire and address humanitarian crisis in Blue Nile and Southern Kordofan states.
It is not transparent. There is no freedom. The humanitarian crisis has not been addressed. It is very serious. There are more than 1 million displaced person in the Nuba Mountain and Blue Nile. The government is denying access, and denying access is a war crime.
Arman says the Sudan government must stop its dry season campaign in Jebel Mara, Nuba Mountains, and Blue Nile.
When World War is going on right now, there is an attack from 8 directions in the Nuba Mountain. The civilians have been attacked on a daily basis by aerial bombardment, and there is a ground attack from 8 directions. The same is in Blue Nile from 3 directions, as well as in Jebel Marra. And the government, they believe in achieving military victory.
The consultation meeting was being facilitated by the African Union High-Level Implementation Panel on Sudan and South Sudan to accelerate progress towards ending the conflict in Darfur, Southern Kordofan and Blue Nile State. VOA fellow Nadia Taha prepared that report. We now turn to Juba, where new FIFA president Gianni Infantino chose South Sudan to be his first stop in an African country, following his election to the top FIFA office 3 weeks ago. Dinani told reporters in Juba today his office will work with South Sudanese football authorities to lift up the standard of soccer in the country. Dinani also came to watch the match between Benin and South Sudan, which ended in 2-1 in Benin's favor. For VOA News, Owaki Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
FIFA President Gianni Infantino met South Sudan President Salva Kiir upon his arrival in Juba today. Infantino says he discussed the status of football with the president in the struggling country. The FIFA boss says he also came to Juba to launch the newly constructed office of the South Sudan Football Association and acquaint himself with the FIFA projects in South Sudan aimed at improving the standard of football in the country.
I come back here, of course, as a FIFA president to watch some football as well, but also to kick off a new era of football, a new era of developing football, a new era of football development, which is our mission.
The 45-year-old lawyer and a career sports administrator first came to South Sudan early last month while campaigning to become the World Football Governing Body's president. Infantino vowed to improve the standard of football in Africa, including South Sudan.
South Sudan will be one of the priorities. We will look at the infrastructure. We have discussed it with the government and with the Football Association, and soon will come up with something concrete there as well that the people of South Sudan will be proud of.
Infantino says he wants to improve training grounds and football pitches in South Sudan. He also wants to train more players, especially young boys and girls, as well as referees. He noted that the structure of football in South Sudan has yet to meet international standards and says he will work on that. Infantino says he also came today to watch the football match between South Sudan and Benin in Juba this evening. Chaburu Goch Alei, the president of the South Sudan Football Association, says the challenges facing professional football in South Sudan are huge.
Starting from the infrastructure, the training for referees and coaches and the national team support and a lot of things actually. For us, we will work together with FIFA and CAF to see how we can start step by step implementing all the goal projects which are going to be approved by FIFA, and we will see the improvement, but we need time.
Alei is urging FIFA to provide financial support for developing football in South Sudan. Infantino, who holds dual nationality, Swiss and Italian, was elected FIFA president on February 26, beating controversial ASEAN Football Confederation president Sheikh Salma bin Ibrahim Al Khalifa in the second round of voting by 115 votes to 88. He has been the general secretary of UEFA since 2009. Infantino replaces his predecessor, Sepp Blatter. In May, U.S. prosecutors unsealed an indictment alleging a World Cup of fraud and arrested a number of senior executives on charges of money laundering and corruption. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
South Sudan's Minister of Finance and Economic Planning says the government will not pay the hotel bills for members of the SPLM former detainees who have been staying at Crown Hotel since December last year. South Sudan in Focus obtained a copy of a letter written by Deng Atorbe to the acting head of the former detainees, Deng Alor Kwal. It explains the government's decision to stop paying the hotel bills of the former detainees by Thursday, March 24th, saying the government has no funds to continue paying accommodation in hotels indefinitely. South Sudan in Focus made repeated calls to John Luke and Modud Biar for comments, but the two members of the SPLM former detainees did not answer our calls. Nearly 3,000 South Sudanese have fled to Uganda in the last 2 weeks to escape violence and food shortages, according to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees office in Uganda. A UNHCR spokesman says more South Sudanese have sought refuge in Uganda this year than of all of the 2015. Mungome Dev Sakarinj has this story for VOA from Juba.
UNHCR spokesperson in Uganda, Charles Yaxley, says they have received more than 40,000 South Sudan refugees since the start of this year. Yaxley says most of the refugees are children and elderly women.
And in the last 2 weeks alone, we've seen nearly 3,000
arrive in Uganda, on top of the 14,000 of Sydney's refugees received in January and February.
He says most of the young people arriving in Uganda are malnourished after days of walking in the bush as they try to escape violence. Yaxel says UNHCR has heard what he calls horrifying stories from the new arrivals.
And they're telling us that they're fleeing armed militia groups that are looting villages, burning down houses, sexually assaulting women and girls, and possibly recruiting children into their ranks. At the same time, the situation is making it very difficult to successfully harvest crops.
The fighting that broke out in December 2013 has left nearly 2 million people displaced, including hundreds of thousands who have fled to neighboring countries of Sudan, Ethiopia, Kenya, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Uganda. Most of the new arrivals, according to Yaxley, are from former Jonglei and Western Equatoria states. Aside from the violence, people flee their villages because they do not have food to eat. And Yaxley says the vast majority of people fleeing their homeland do not have money to buy food. Alison Martin is the coordinator of the Red Cross in Greater Western Equatoria. He says most South Sudanese fleeing their villages are women and children.
Also, men were among them. You know, people left individually. Some others, too many to take their belongings. Some others, too few to take it. They've just left. You know, it was a crisis situation.
Yaxle says such stories are common. He remembers one particular story from an old woman whose family members left her alone in Jonglei State.
Eventually, she was pushed to the edge. She told me one night militia groups came, they burned down her farm, they killed her cattle, and left her with nothing, leaving her no choice but to flee. And the journey from South Sudan to Uganda, not easy. This old woman told me how her bones were aching.
The UN and other humanitarian agencies have warned of a looming famine in South Sudan unless the fighting ends immediately. If it does, people can return their homes and farm their gardens. UNHCR officials in Uganda say they have received at least 200,000 refugees since the conflict began. The South Sudanese refugees are sheltering at various refugee settlements in Uganda. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
One day after World Water Day, some residents in Wau say it's extremely difficult to access clean drinking water, which puts their lives at risk of waterborne diseases. Some women say they have to wake up as early as 2 a.m. every day and walk several miles to join often long queues at the new available boreholes to fetch water for their families. Dimo Silva Aurelio has the story for VOA from Wau.
Dozens of women are gathered at this Rivabis borehole in the Gonia residential neighborhood. All of them have put their water containers in a long queue awaiting their turn to fetch clean water each day. Some of these women say they purposely wake up in the middle of the night in order to queue up and fetch their water by midday, then turn round and walk, carry the water back home. Regina Francis is one of the women at the borehole.
It's now 12 a.m. and I have not even dumped one jerrycan water. And there are children in school. Those ahead of me dumped one jerrycan water only. And the water cuts off. There is no way to buy water because one jerrycan costs £3.
Feroz Alinana, a mother of four, is lucky today because she was able to fill or have four jerrycans with water at the borehole, which will be used by the 20 members of her family. Alinana says she had to wake up all grown-up girls as early as 3 a.m. and ask them to go with her and fetch water from the nearest borehole.
The time we wake up to go and collect the water is very bad time, not good time for women to leave their home at that time. Sometimes we wake at 2 at night or sometimes at 4 to go and collect the water to bring it home. Because early in the morning, the kids are take water for washing, for bathing, for make tea, and then they went to school in the morning. Sometimes when you go late, like when you left at 4 or 5, then you can come back maybe at 8, 9.
She says in the past her family used to spend 600 South Sudanese pounds per week to buy water. She says nowadays the family spends double that amount, especially when she and the grown-up girls in the family are unable to collect water from the borehole.
When the weather is very hot like that, I spend for months like 600 for water only, because this is the time for people, for pupils go to schools and me going to the office or where I'm working. So I'm just use a lot of water.
Sebit Petrino Rabi, Director of Water and Sanitation Hygiene in Wau, says most water sources in Wau are not safe. He advises residents to ensure all drinking water is treated with chlorine.
In the town here, we have two sources, that is the urban water supply, and then we have the hand pumps, which was drilled before in the town. In the rainy season, it's okay, but like this time now, people are facing challenges in accessing safe water. We have these water vendors, they get water from the open hand dug wells. We used to support them with chlorine. The issue is taking water from the source and then keeping them in the containers.
Rabi says most community water maintenance committees in Wau have collapsed in most residential areas, so that maintaining water sources have become a big challenge.
We have water committees for each borehole that is comprising of 5 members, 3 women and then 2 men, including the caretaker. We used to give them the spanner for weekly check up the bolts and nuts. The main issue is this work is a voluntary job, and most of the time you get the community insulting the committee, they give up. Ownership of the facility is one of the main challenges.
Residents complain that the few available boreholes do not only pump dirty water, but also often run dry for several hours per day, something that keeps people queuing at the borehole for long hours in the hot sun. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Wau.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we continue to take a look at the work of UN mission in South Sudan. That story is coming up shortly.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what quality is most important to you in the person you are planning to marry?
Definitely trust, sharing the same values, but trust is the most important. You have to be able to trust your partner and just rely on them and as much as you accept them for who they are.
So I'm already married, and I think I wouldn't narrow it to one characteristic, but the thing that was most important, I think, for both of us was that we each had the same sort of life goals.
Respect, that is one. Faith, as in faithful, doesn't cheat, respects, and beauty comes last. Yeah, that's what it is me I try to look at. That's what I'm looking for.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. We continue our series today on the United Nations by taking an in-depth look at the United Nations Charter that governs UN peacekeepers. The charter was signed in the U.S. city of San Francisco, California, in 1945. 71 years later, it continues to guide UN personnel serving around the world. The chapter is a treaty and all member states are bound to it. There are 19 chapters in all, but perhaps the most important ones regarding peacekeeping activities are chapters 6 and 7. Ayen Bior has more from Washington.
Dr. Lise Howard, Georgetown University professor in international relations in Washington, D.C., says the UN Charter's 2 chapters that govern peacekeepers are conflicting, especially the rules regarding the use of force in Chapter 7 and the 3 guiding principles under Chapter 6.
Those 3 are the non-use of force or limited force only in self-defense, consent of the warring parties, and impartiality.
Chapter 6 is referred to as the diplomatic chapter. It covers diplomatic needs like incentives, mediations, and military exchanges. It also guides member states and peacekeepers on proper protocol when dealing with disagreements. It demands that peacekeepers refer unresolved issues to the UN Security Council. Howard says the three principles of Chapter 6 are the foundation of peacekeeping. She says when it comes to impartiality, it is important to remember that this principle does not mean neutrality.
In other words, the UN wasn't supposed to be neutral, but impartial in the sense that a judge in a court of law is impartial. So if somebody's violating their promises in a peace accord, the UN was supposed to call them out on it, not remain neutral, but remain impartial as an impartial arbiter, like a judge in settling disputes.
Chapter 7 is referred to as the enforcement chapter. It's the chapter that peacekeepers in South Sudan are operating under, as opposed to Chapter 6. This chapter covers any action that threatens the peace, including acts of aggression against civilians and peacekeepers. Howard points out the principles in Chapter 6 are in direct conflict with Chapter 7. For one, she says it is difficult to uphold the principle of impartiality when Chapter 7 allows the use of force to protect civilians.
Because obviously if you're using force, peacekeepers can be drawn into firefights. They're no longer impartial because they're actually fighting. Nobody consents to being fired on.
Howard says peacekeeping is not designed to achieve its goals through the use of force, but at the same time, peacekeepers cannot do their jobs if they are unable to protect themselves or innocent civilians. She says there are two views of peacekeeping. The Chapter 6 view is where peacekeeping is primarily a nonviolent way to settle disputes. Chapter 7 is where peacekeepers can be seen as an extension of an ongoing conflict or war and must have use of force at their disposal. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
The deputy head of the UN mission in South Sudan says UNMISS operates under Chapter 7 in South Sudan. Mustafa Shomari says the UNMISS force of 12,000 troops under Chapter 7 are authorized to repel attacks on civilians within UN facilities.
The mission here in South Sudan operates under Chapter 7. Chapter 7 means it's really like you give the mission the authority to actually act without getting any kind of permission, authorization, and so on. But this is in theory how it is, that it is, you know. But for example, in countries where the government has collapsed completely, where there is no government and so on, in the Chapter 7, you actually play the role of the government. But now, because of the seriousness of the situation in this country, we have been granted the Chapter 7, but we are still working with a government, which is a sovereign government. And we have to always have that in view, so that really there are always times where we have to go to the government and we need anyway to engage with the government to make sure that we create this good relation, we build trust with the government. Because as I say, the primary focus of our mandate is protection of civilians, and there is no way we can do that alone. And we have to do that with the government. You need to know the objective is for us to reach peace in a long-lasting manner, and we must do so with the people of South Sudan. And this is really very important. That's why our work with the government and so on is really key, even though we have Chapter 7.
And in this Chapter 7, my understanding is also that your troops have the mandate to shoot if they are attacked. And in the event of what happened in Malakal, a lot of South Sudanese are still wondering, how did the peacekeepers fail to protect the civilians who were killed by gunmen in Malakal?
This in theory, what you say is absolutely right. But Chapter 7, there are conditions on which really the force can actually engage in using the firearms. One is, first of all, it's self-protection. You fire on them and so on, they need to fire. They need also to use that if really the population is in a situation whereby people are really shooting at them and so on, and the only way to do that is for them to shoot against those who are shooting on them, and also in terms of protecting the UN assets. This is important. So there are guidelines, very clear guidelines, which have been developed in terms of really making sure that really this lethal kind of arms are not used just immediately. We always must actually to avoid collateral casualties. For example, what has happened in Malakal is exactly that, where you find the military there
between the internal displaced people, meaning civilians, and people shooting from outside. And, you know, using then firearm could be actually creating more casualties.
That's Mustafa Shomari, deputy head of the UN mission in South Sudan. He was speaking to me from Juba. Tomorrow we will hear from the top UN diplomat about the challenges of operating under Chapter 7. We asked several South Sudanese in Bor what they think of the work of UNMISS and how they would rate it on a scale of 1 to 10. Here is what they had to say.
I'll give them 8, and out of that 8 I can say, in the side of protection of civilians, they have been doing good. Though the recent incident happened, but they were at least helping in the crisis. And also in the development part of it, I've seen some work of them that they have done, like construction of roads and other activities that they have done. For example, the road that connects some areas in Ju River, Bajok, had been constructed by UN.
My name is Philip George Mukwe. Yes, I can give one position to UN because the UNMISS in South Sudan, sometimes they are harmful to the government and they are not supporting the government of South Sudan. One of the factors is that in terms of military position, it happened in the year 2014, whereby they load one of the trucks and they launched it up to Rumbex, whereby they were caught by the SPLA soldiers. It was loaded with a heavy machine gun, which is not the position of the UN, and there was no information from the military base. This thing, if the UNMISS is not collaborating with the government and they do all this thing without any knowledge from the government, it means the UNMISS is not working with the government of South Sudan together.
Well, I can give UN one because in the places that they built camps, or a makeshift camp for IDPs, that were the places that the war started during 2013. And they also invest in insecurity because they generate our own tribalism to make it their own way of living. And this is what is affecting us today. So I can give them grade one.
My name is Bola Isaac. It would be better if I rank UN around 9. First of all, UN is running its mandate, is doing it, though not perfect, but it's trying because in everything that we do, there are challenges. And however, they're doing their work. It's okay.
I'm Rhoda in Malwar. Yeah, I can say the position of UN, I think, is 2. Because why I say so, UN now, I don't see any changes here in South Sudan about what they are doing in South Sudan. So I'm not seeing any changes.
In my opinion, I can rate them in 8 out of 10 because seeing the UN mission start in South Sudan here, there is some help that I really experience, and I hope they should increase and they go on well for the next time to improve, to be in the 3rd position out of 10. And I hope the UN mission will improve.
This is South Sudanese talking about how they view the role of the UN mission in South Sudan. We'll have more on the role of UNMISS and what it has accomplished in tomorrow's show. That's our show for Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Gao by Magic System. I'm afraid we don't have enough time for that music. I'm John Tanza in Washington. You have a wonderful day. Changer de côté, oh.